Everybody, can you hear me? It's me, it's Chris. Hi guys, it's Chris Marquette.
Gotcha! You had to turn up the volume. Now you gotta turn it back down! Welcome to the Coogan Chronicles podcast, a podcast where two former child actors
interview other former child actors.
About what?
About what growing up in the about? Biz?
Growing up in the biz, being actors as kids? Grinding? Hustling, making that dollar, yeah, baby. Guys, sorry, we're in the midst of still trying to figure out how we start off.
I'm figuring it out.
We're getting comfortable. We're learning this craft. This is a new.
You know, I feel like when you figure out the intro, Chris, you will have figured out yourself.
I will. That's what will happen. I'll just turn into a beam of white light. I will just disappear. No one will ever see me again. Like, what happened? Like,
in the meantime, it's a work in progress, and that's okay.
That's exactly,
you're human.
Yeah. That's all right. That's all right. I'm not levitating yet. AJ, for anyone who obviously can't see him, for everyone is what I'm about to say. AJ, right before we started, had to put on some chapstick. He just had to make sure those lips were nice and smooth when he's talking. When he's talking on the microphone, he's got to make sure his lips are nice and smooth. Yeah, look at that. Got those smooth lips. That's what we got now. Oh man, boy, you're a weirdo. You got AJ's got a little Rain Man in him.
Yeah, right. I'm the weirdo that puts on chapstick.
Yep, he's got to put on a little chapstick right before I start talking. Yep. Okay, guys. Today we are talking to Christy Romano. AJ's longtime coworker and friend. I've known Christy since we were kids, probably before you actually met Christy.
Definitely.
Growing up in New York, hustling for that dollar, baby. That's when we knew each other. And AJ and I, we had something we wanted to talk about before we get into Christy's wonderful interview and just great interview with us. And that's that we realize we do this annoying thing when we talk to people sometimes. I think we did it with Mara. We've definitely done it with a few guests where we, in the beginning of the interview, we bring up something that we want to talk about with them.
The juiciest detail, like the peak of the interview, the best part. It's almost like we're teasing it a little bit.
Yeah,
like,
we're going to tease
it
a little.
Coming up there on this episode, yeah. But hold on. Let's not get
hold
there
on
yet.
Yeah, and then that's what we do. We back off. We go, no, we'll get to it in just a little while, okay? And then what happens is we get totally lost in the conversation. And then we completely forget to go back to those things. And it isn't until after we're done talking with our guests that we suddenly go, dude, we didn't even get there. What are we doing? And that's what we did with Christy. Christy, we're going to share a link on the podcast here that you can click on.
Know
Christy,
how it works. We're going to
put we're going to put a link out anyway
in the show notes. Chris, we're going to put a link in the show notes.
Put the link in the show notes. We're still, look, it's a new medium.
I could see your brain trying to compute that. Like, wait, this is an audio medium. We're going to put a link, but they can't hear the link. How does it work?
That's good, guys. I'm just here to talk. All right, I'm not here to do anything else. You guys figured out. Google. You can Google this. Christy Romano wrote an article for Teen Vogue in 2019, mid 2019. And we found it. We had no idea she wrote it. She didn't tell us, but we do our internet research on our guests. And we found it and we read it and I was blown away by it. I thought it was absolutely incredible. And AJ and I sat there and read it and we were so in awe of Christy's honesty and her bravery and eloquence and how well she understood herself. And we just think it was so wonderful that she came out so publicly and talked about herself really honestly and her time as a kid actor and talked about how that affected her as an adult and everything we want to have in these conversations, right, with guests. So we start off this interview with Christy. We say, we can't wait to get to so much of that article. We got so many questions for you, so many things we want to delve into. And then we just talk about all kinds of stuff that had nothing to do with the article. I mean, everything to do with it, but mainly nothing specific. So before we get to Christy's interview and give it to you guys, we just wanted to touch on a couple of the things actually that she wrote in there that we didn't get to talk to her about, but that I think will really inform and frame the conversation that we have with her and frame the conversations we have in the future in general. It's almost like this conversation with former kid actors is one giant conversation, us too. That's kind of how we feel. So
yeah, we also encourage you, if you like some of the quotes that Chris is going to read from the article, that you go out and check out the article for yourself because it's a great read. And she wrote it herself and she did a great job.
And she really did. You know, I think here's the first thing I'm going to read from her article. I'm going to read to you guys. She wrote, "While many witnessed my co-star Shia LaBeouf," who's that guy? Everybody knows who that guy is, "struggle publicly, I have largely suffered in silence. I am not a victim, but I have never been perfect or pulled together as my reputation or the successes of my young adulthood might suggest." And that's kind of the way that she starts this article. And the reason I started with that is because I don't know if anyone will realize, I think it's an incredibly brave thing to do and very, very humble and thoughtful. And this is why. One, I'm sure for Christy, for if you're going to grow up acting alongside an actor like Shia LaBeouf that ends up becoming this big famous movie star and then like struggles over and over and over again in his life, and seemingly the world is paying attention and forgiving him or taking care of him, or his career keeps sort of moving in a good direction, obviously up until recently, then you know, you going through similar struggles without that attention, without that your career continually sort of holding yourself up, is really difficult. And I think that's something really difficult for any former kid actor to acknowledge if you aren't Shia LaBeouf. You don't become that, you know, huge person that's able, like that Robert Downey Jr. sort of person who's able to go in and out of jail and still work, you know, and still have respect and still your talent still blossoms and grows. And, you know, it's like not everybody gets that. And her to once acknowledge that and then immediately say, I'm not a victim, to me was like one of the, when I read that, I was like, that's so beautiful for her to acknowledge that and say that. Cause the truth is that of any conversation we'll ever have with a former kid actor, you know, there's no real victimhood here. I don't think any former kid actor is a victim because they were a former kid actor. I think that there are pitfalls. I think that there are things that can be really challenging and difficult for any person in general to get through, but that will definitely be waiting there around the corner as you become an adult if you were a former kid actor. But I don't think that qualifies somebody as a victim necessarily. And so I really love that she kind of immediately acknowledges that and starts off saying, before I say anything else, I want to make that really clear, you know? And I think that's really brave. I think that is. Because it's so easy to kind of take the other route, right, AJ? It's so easy to just kind of say, yeah, well, you know, I had all this, this is what was pinned against me and this is what I had to fight against and, you know, and just blame it on any sort of outside thing.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah.
You know, and I feel like that's the easy way to go and she didn't do that. And the other part about it real fast is that when she says, you know, her reputation or the successes of her young adulthood might suggest that she was pulled together perfect. And that now she's about to say, actually, it was the complete opposite. You know, she goes on later to say that she felt like at one point she was told leaving Hollywood right after even Stevens would ruin her career. And she feels like she did ruin her career. And then she talks about how dealing with that, that she felt like she started to binge drink and she was like scratching herself as a form of self-destruction and harming herself. And that she sort of, you know, couldn't hold on to relationships and friendships and struggled in all those areas of her life. And that is the complete opposite of this image. Right.
Well, and even as her friend and knowing her through those years, and I think we touch on this in our conversation as well, I thought Christy was super pulled together. She definitely gave off that vibe, you know, both in the character that she played when I worked with her with Ren Stevens, but then also in her life, she seemed very pulled together. And
yeah, you wouldn't guess, right?
Yeah.
And that's the thing maybe we didn't unfortunately get to touch on specifically about the article she wrote that I was so blown away by is that acknowledgement. Because here's my firm belief. My firm belief is that a majority of 99% of former kid actors who were on wholesome Disney shows or wholesome television shows or movies where their image becomes one of that, of being pulled together and you're fine and you're like you got it all, you're totally fine. That person is gonna live with that watermarked on their life for a really long time, probably as long as they let it. And that's a really difficult thing to grapple with when you're a human being and you've got things to go through in life that don't look like that, that don't look like you're pulled together and perfect. And so here she is. She goes into, you guys should read this article because she goes in depth about.
Well, yeah. Before you get into all of the other things, I would almost just say to you, Chris, we should encourage people to go check out the article. Yeah. Excellent. And listen to our conversation with Christy, because she opens up about a lot of stuff. And that is the opener. Yeah. I know you could go on for another.
I could go on. You're right. But only because this, I'll just leave it at that. I'm amazed that we somehow talked with her for like 2 hours and didn't get to these things.
Only
so I just want to incorporate.
That, Chris.
I know, but I just wanted to incorporate
that
it.
Long and not touch on these topics.
But if people are going to listen to us talk with Christy for a while, I just wanted them to hear a couple of these things. Because I just think I really do think it's so brave and it's so beautiful of her. And she obviously was so thoughtful and brought so much humility and heart to this article. And we didn't get to bring up these specific. But I just wanted to be part of our conversation because we touch on this in many ways in the conversation. So check it out. We appreciate you guys listening. And so anything else to add, AJ? What else you got?
I think that was pretty thorough. That was good.
Okay, it was thorough. All right, guys. Without further ado, our chat with Christy Romano. I mean, I guess maybe right off the bat, when we looked into you, because that's what we have to do with everybody, is we start Googling everybody, because we realize, like, you know, despite us all knowing each other for a long time and being friends, so we Googled you and stuff, and there was immediately like 1,000 surprises, like for both of us. Yeah, immediately we were like, wow. And the biggest surprise, I think, perhaps for both of us, was that you had written a really beautiful article for Teen Vogue about your whole life. And so we read it and we were like, wow, we didn't know 90% of the story. Mm-hmm. And two, we didn't know that you had divulged your life like that. And we were in shock. We were amazed. And we just sat there. We were like, man, you're incredible and you're great. And there's a ton of questions. What don't we know about you? Or what doesn't anybody know about you that you worked on as a kid?
Yeah. I mean, starting at the beginning it's interesting, right? It's like, how do you unpack something? So it almost feels so distant, but also so predominant in your memory bank. My mom is visiting, as a side note here, you know, she's 73 and she's, was my momager, Chris and Aiden, you both know her. And she very much talks about the past a lot. Like it's something that's very vivid for her, because I know as a parent, she must have been through so much on my behalf. And now as a parent, it's like, whoa, like that's hitting me in so many new ways. And so when she brings up a lot of these memories, sometimes I'm like, okay, I know, because I know my interpretation of starting from the beginning. But it is fascinating to see things kind of continually coming full circle. So yeah, so I was in my first national commercial, which back then national commercials were the thing, you know, when you were 6 years old. The thing was it national, you know, or was it regional? We had separate, okay, I think we actually either had, it was either hyphens or separate columns in our resumes, right? That said regional or national commercial. Like that was a very important thing for some reason to casting if you had been in like a regional or a national commercial. And I don't know if it was because when you see a child, you instantly tokenize them and be like, well, are they national level exploitation?
Yeah, I wonder how they differentiate and what it means on the other side of things. Yeah, because as a kid actor, it means like a lot more money, a lot more like visibility, obviously. The agents are obviously way more excited. And it's usually a much more interesting shoot, like altogether. It'll be, you know, like for those, you're like, they're flying me to Vegas and I'm going to be on the strip. Jumping off the fake Eiffel Tower. Awesome. National commercials rule. Regional commercials, you're like, they want me to sit at the bus stop and like eat crackers off the ground. Okay. Regional
they
commercials.
They want me to stand in front of all of this landscaping equipment and talk about like how good these hedge cutters are.
That's regional for you. But yeah, there is a massive differentiation. But so you booked the first thing as a big national commercial. So you're just like vaulted into.
No.
No.
No, in fact, the first thing that I booked was called Warm and Tender. It was a dog, and they had a cat option, but it was basically like a water heating pad, you know, like, and you would fill this dog that was completely deflated in with hot water, and it was jiggly because it was made of latex, and it would get warm, and then you'd be able to hug it. Guys, I still have the link for this. You can.
That's
can
a great product. That is a COVID-friendly product. That is some Netflix and chill type shit right there. Everybody needs one of those.
No, it was recalled.
Oh, really? That was it. Yeah. So it obviously harmed a lot of children.
Were supposed to put scalding water in this like dog thing and hug it to a child who's going to hug scalding hot water. How dumb is this? So you have me in this thing and I'm like hugging it. And then I got to sing the jingle. So that was like a big thing. And I was very excited about that. And then after that, I remember like doing like tests for national commercials. I remember Lacey Chabert booked this Zestfully Clean. And I remember, oh my gosh, guys, I remember having to go and test right after around the same time. I was so scared because they were doing this thing where you had to go in and basically be topless. And I was what, 8 years old or something? And you had to go in and you had to be willing to be in like a set that was Zestfully Clean. So they would used to do this thing, I'm Zestfully Clean. Yeah. And they would have like bubbles, right? And you would be like soaping yourself up. And I remember having, and guys, I'm super like, this is something that we're like, we're opening. This is some therapy right now.
This is it.
I remember that was really scary to like, I remember my mom even being like, well, you know, like this is just what we're going to do. But I don't think she meant anything wrong because I guess maybe back then it wasn't considered like, this is kind of weird and going to traumatize your child.
Yeah, maybe we should do background checks on everybody that's on set. Yeah.
And that they're filming this and that, you know, those are like lost footage. So I just remember feeling very odd. And of course, I didn't book that. And then it's weird how when you start to remember the beginning, you remember how many failures happened and that eventually it led you to success. But it was really hard work as a kid, man.
It's a lot of work. I mean, you audition. I mean, did you audition like... Probably a lot of us auditioned, re-auditioning sometimes multiple times a day.
I think so. Honestly, I look back now and I'm so jealous of how many auditions I got because now it's like so few and far between. But yeah. I mean, and I hear some people are like, you know, blessed to be like, well, I have like five today or whatever this week. And that's great. But it's a different market now. And
for sure,
especially as a kid, I think there's a lot less competition. Some ways there was less competition when the younger you are than the more the charismatic kind of person can win, the kid can win.
Yeah, if you're talented as a young person, it stands out. It's very clear. And you're going to work if you're talented as a kid.
100%. Especially if you're a good listener, your parents aren't totally crazy, although that's not always the case.
Although sometimes that works in your favor too. Somehow that breeds a really good actor.
Oh my God, you're right, man. You're right.
Yeah. So Christy, starting at six, was it definitively your choice or was your mom or somebody else in your family encouraging to you getting going?
I think it was symbiotic. I honestly do. I think that like my personality really was that of someone who wanted attention. And I was the youngest of four. I didn't have a way of maybe, you know, I was a mama's girl. I kind of still am. But I think it was sort of this thing where it was like, I'm getting the attention I need. I am also getting praised. Like I get one-on-one time with mom, you know, I get to feel special. Like I think that that must have been at a young age, something that kind of worked for me, you know? And I think it was that thing of like, wow, this is the momentum was going very, it was slow for a while. And in some ways it being slow and not booking something immediately was structure for me as an adolescent, you know, the not working so often, but, you know, taking the train into the city from Connecticut, which was about an hour and a half each way, you know, it was uncomplicated. I knew what to expect. You know, we'd show up, I'd do the shtick and then I'd leave. And then every time, and I did mention this in the Teen Vogue article, like every time I actually booked something, my mom and I would go to this crystal store on the corner across from Grand Central, because that's where I would go and take the train home. And when we would get a call like, hey, you actually booked it, you got it, you know, because they would make the decision right after you'd go in for the callback. And it was already, my adrenaline was already so high as a child for having been on the spot for the callback and knowing that, you know, it was a very adult decision to be making. Like if I had booked something, I knew that would have repercussions within my family dynamic. And I was that young, 8 years old really now, knowing that that would happen. Almost like, oh my gosh, like divorce. It's like on that level of serious.
Do you mind me asking, like what were the repercussions? Like what ripple effect did that have in your family?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was almost immediate when I got a national tour when I was about 8 years old. I was kind of just doing the commercial thing and in and out of the city until then. And then I got Will Rogers Follies, which was a vaudevillian, very flashy Broadway show at the time. And they were doing their first national tour. And I had gotten an understudy part and they had asked me to like cut my hair off. And I had very, very, very long hair at the time as a little girl. And my mom had like kept it long for commercials. And
they couldn't just put a wig on a kid?
They did.
A little girl cut her hair off?
We actually had to dig our heels in and be like, my mom actually stood up for that. And so that came with its own consequences in terms of them feeling like I was difficult, you know, an 8-year old difficult, not wanting to
shave her head. She won't go back to grade school with a shaved ass head. That little girl, she's difficult, little diva.
I'm telling you, they were really hard.
She'll give up her entire life and heavily affect her family life to come on tour with us for 6 months with a bunch of adults that are total crackheads when the show's not going on.
And if she grows an inch or two, we're going to fire her immediately. But that's totally not
good. Guys, for real, like And so I left the family. I remember, I also remember my mom talking to my dad, having this, why I was in the room, I will never know. But we must have just found out that we booked it, right? I feel like intuitively she knew this was the beginning of something, a journey for me. And she always had that mantra in her mind and in her heart about supporting my career. And of course, that gets more complex as we get older. But I remember sitting across vividly that desk from my dad, and he was like, so you're leaving. Okay, what would this entail? And there was like a whole interrogation with my mom and my dad back and forth. And I was there. And I think my mom wanted me to look at him and say, like, this is what I want. And I was 8.5 years old.
Yeah.
So, you know, these are really odd circumstances, you know, that then bring you to a place where you have to be held accountable for hitting your marks and remembering your lines, and then interactions with other kids who have their own dynamics with their families. I remember that there was other kids on that play, and, you know, everyone was at different pubescent levels. So there was some hormonal things happening. And then there's like, you know, bitchy behaviors between like me, the girl I was understudying, and, you know, the, you know, me. The thing is, though, it's that you almost don't want to remember it, because like sometimes I'll even say to my mom, like, mom, like even my husband will be like, mom, like, you don't need to continually live in the past or anything, you know, like, let's let that be that for what that was. So I have had a lot of introspective thought, but it's fun to talk to you guys about this, because I think as we talk, like, these things are pinging in my brains, and like little connections that I may not have made in that article or other things, like, they're all going to be coming up. So that's bringing us to, you know, 10 or something.
That's bringing you to 10 already. Yeah, exactly. So for you, though, then when you look at that whole before Even Stevens, before then, like, becoming a teenager and moving to Los Angeles and stuff, you know, that when you look at all your experience then, and I'm sure all the different jobs and auditions you had, and how your family life obviously changes, I'm sure, in wildly different ways, depending on the jobs and stuff. What do you remember? Like, how does that all feel to you? Does it feel chaotic?
I mean, like, yeah, I feel like there's an A and a B there. So like the A part is, while it was happening, I was definitely, you know, there's this term of like assuming the position. And I think that's kind of what I was doing, is I was really connected to my relationship with my mom. And we became this like invincible team. And like, there was these mantra, this mentality of us against the world. And there was this romanticism of us building something, me making something of myself on her back, essentially, and us, you know, doing it together. So I didn't want to let that down. I felt like very supported by her, and I did feel disconnected from the rest of my siblings because they were also older. My brother was, you know, four years older than me, but at a point when I was, you know, 8, he's what?
12, yeah.
12, like, I don't know. There's significant difference. Like, I don't think, and then as we got older, we became friendlier, but I was very separated from them for a very long time. So much so that I didn't feel like I was a part of the family. Sometimes my mom would even say, you know, like, your siblings are different. They're being raised differently than you. And when I would come home to visit them, even 8 years old, I would know that difference. I see some videos and I say things in these videos that just aren't right.
Like, what do you mean? Meaning, like, did you feel superior, or what was not right?
Yeah, I felt like my siblings were hicks or something. Like, I don't know, or that they were unruly, uncivilized, like, not cultured, you know, like that. I was able to be, I was more, not that I never thought that I was more special than them, but I think what it was me overcompensating for not understanding what it meant like to be normal. And I really wanted to be normal, but I felt very alone, you know, like, I felt like I was in another family. Like, I was a stepchild. I didn't even feel like I was part of that marriage.
Was there resentment from your siblings towards you at that time too? Cause you, I mean, you kind of took your mom away, sort of. I don't know if I have a similar story as well. My brothers are 7 and 9 years older than me, and my mom and I left town, and they were older. They were, like, you know, borderline college at that time, but we still left town. So was there some resentment from them of mom leaving with you and you guys going and pursuing all that stuff?
Definitely. I think it comes out even to this day. My two oldest sisters, right? They're like 42 and 41 or something. And I mean, I hopefully they won't hear this, but I mean, they're kind of a mess. And like, I think they talk down to my mom a lot and they're like, you know, you left this, you left that. And it comes out later in life. And it's mostly at a certain point up to the people to get help and support and grow from what they had or didn't have or feel like they were owed or stuff like that. I think over time, my mom's definitely, she moved back to Connecticut and she's been there for them in ways that, you know, speak for themselves. So that's all between them. Do you know what I mean? As it relates to my connection or relationship with them, I mean, they had 8 years to bond with me as a child and a baby, and I was the youngest. So I do think that must have been very hard on them to lose me. I know that my sisters had started in like competitions and dance competitions, and they're very big on the East Coast and they were doing all that stuff, you know, like the awards and medals, and, you know, that's how I got scouted. But yeah, so then there's that purview, I guess you could say, like from the account of it, me being there. But then looking back, I think that I was in a dangerous position because as much as my mom was trying to create an infrastructure for me, she tried very hard. So much so that like I left and went to college when I could have stayed behind and, you know, after even Stevens. And she always pushed that, you know, education was important and that I should. But that wasn't exactly helpful for me either because I was never going to be normal. And I think what maybe she didn't understand was that I was struggling with my identity even before I had one.
Yeah, because you're sculpting it out at that time. You know, you're trying to start. Yeah. I mean, you know, from what I remember, that for me, it was the same. I mean, I always talk about how I had this dual life, you know, going into, you know, I'd go to Jersey and I'd have these kids that I was friends with that knew me in some way. And they all seemed on track to like, my friend Matt's dad owned the bagel shop in town. And I was like, Matt's going to own a bagel shop. And this other kid, Jason, was like, you know, his dad was a coach of Little League. I was like, you're going to be a Little League coach one day, you know? And then there I am showing up to like Madison Square Garden performing in front of God knows how many people. And I was like, this is different. This is still, and I don't know what my life's going to look like. You just don't know. And as you're sculpting out your identity, you know,
your parents have no frame of reference to show you the way either. So you're figuring it out for yourself.
You're free falling. I mean, I don't even go to the park with my children. And maybe that's because of what I've experienced, but literally I'm not introverted by any means. And I do like to do things. I like to have parties and I like to host and I like to do things, but I don't even go to the park with my two daughters unless I have help, support, my husband, someone, so that I feel like I'm covered. I don't trust anybody, and it's a problem. Like, I'm finding that this is an issue for me, that I can't let go of control. But that being said, I'll always go back to, but this is what's going to keep us safe. You know, this structure, I always go back to it now. And I think maybe even in talking to you, I'm realizing that that's interrelated to that to some degree.
Perhaps then that life and that time felt unsafe to you and was this like very out of control, didn't really know where, what lane you're carving out or where you're supposed to be going. And that, you know, and that's how it bleeds into your adult life, is that all of a sudden you're looking for that and trying to find your sense of safety. You know, that makes total sense. I totally relate to that.
Christy, you were talking about having an identity crisis, really, because you don't know who you are as a young person. You don't know who you are as a young actor and being 18 and do you go to school or not knowing exactly what you want. And it's interesting because it's so normal for kids to go through that. You don't know who you are. But the difference with the young child actor, and especially one that has notoriety like you did, is you're expected to be somebody. You're expected to have this identity. And if you don't figure that out for yourself, it's so quickly going to be assigned to you.
Well, you're given one.
Yeah, you're stuck with it.
Yeah, it's not even expected. It's you are given one. I don't know. When I heard you speak, it made me think of like, oh, right. Like all of a sudden when you're in that adult world, working professionally too, there is an identity you do have to adopt to be part of the adult world. You know, you're not just hanging out with your peers and you're not just in school. It'd be like going to class and it being all teachers, you know, like no other kids your age. Like you would have to adopt a different personality in that class and by sheer majority stake. And so I think there's always going to be something like that to the life of a kid actor where you when you're thrust into an adult world and you're talking to adults and you're working with them, and they're talking to you and they're explaining to you things and you're, you know, and you're spending all this time with them, that I imagine there's a, you're going to have to pick up and adopt this, this other idea, a very adolescent, small idea that you have of who you need to be then and there, and dragging that back and forth to a normal life, you know, in school or with siblings and with your parents and stuff, and going oscillating between the two, I imagine can feel really chaotic.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically essentially bypassing your childhood, and then the rest of it's a farce. Like going back to school after you've performed at Madison Square Garden is just a farce.
Yeah.
I am doing this. I remember I was like super young, and I think I told my music teacher, I was like, time is money. And I was like, you know, eight. Really? I had to get on the train, you know, and definitely had a hard time with that. I also don't understand why people, when actors who've grown up in the industry like us say, hey, maybe don't get your kid in the business because like this is why it's complicated, or this is a complex thing. I just want you to be aware of this. They always do this thing. Oh, it's whatever, you know, like they're going to make money and they're going to be happy. And you're like, no. Wait, walk it back. Like I just said, their childhood is going to be bypassed. That means that, you know what I'm saying? Like that dichotomy is not respected by prospective stage parents, and it really should be.
Do you think your mom feels that way now that your childhood was bypassed?
But the thing about my mom is that I think she tried her best to, better than most, to create a reward system that allowed for me to go home and sort of find some friends that were local, even though I wasn't in school. Like it was always some sort of a struggle to have some foundation of like equal footing of friendships and have like my own community. It was constantly a struggle.
So on this reward system, can this bring us back to the crystals and you getting the call that you booked a job? And what's going on with these crystals?
Okay, so crystals were a thing that we got, and so it was a celebratory thing. You know, it was like, hey, like we found out we booked something. This is what you want.
We're gonna buy some jewels. Let's get some jewels.
This is legit. I literally still have them, and I could probably pull them out. I think I know where they are. I still have them, which is so crazy to me. And most of them are broken. And I have them wrapped up in a rag, and like I've transported them. And originally they had their own case, and like I had mixed feelings about having them in the case. And now that I have the girls, I'm like, do I want the girls to have these? Or
are these my special crystals? Magical jewels?
Or, like, is this the one thing I don't give? Is there an energy here that I don't want to bestow upon?
That makes sense. Yeah.
Oh, right.
It's so funny because I have the equivalent, but like maybe it's the 10-year-old boy equivalent, which is you got cool crystals with your mom. I got Star Wars action figures with my mom. And that was like that or an X-Men comic book at the Port Authority bus terminal in New York. But it was that. I was like, I booked a thing. And you were like, great, let's celebrate.
Yeah.
Do you need another Ewok? And I'm like, I definitely need another Ewok.
If we go through this whole section, I know my mother's going to listen to this episode for sure.
For sure.
If we go through this whole section, Kathy. I don't mention my mother getting me into crystals, I'll get a text about it. So I'm just going to say here.
My mom got you so into crystals.
My mom was really into crystals too, but it wasn't like air-shaped.
I wonder if she got that from Christy and her mom.
This is independent. It wasn't bear-shaped crystals. It would be crystals that would like help me with creativity or help me sleep at night or like be soothing. So they would have certain properties, certain metaphysical properties, these crystals and I would go to bed with them under my pillow or like put them in my pocket for auditions and stuff. I remember being a kid being like, Mom, do you have a feeling about this audition? She would have certain feelings about it.
Yeah. I don't know. I always liked your mom quite a lot. I've always loved her. Actually,
I think the feeling's mutual, Christy.
I think so. Yeah. It took her about 15 years to like me, but that's fine.
That's a good guy. Like,
who's this goober who can't carry a surfboard correctly? Chris, get in the back of the car.
Chris was a bull in a china shop every day at my mom's house.
You know, walk us through two things before we get to like your whole experience with Even Stevens and both you guys going into that. But like, how does that happen? Because you're in New York and you got to relocate now to LA and you got to move across the whole country and you got to leave your family. Like what?
Yeah. How was that conversation between your parents?
So at that point, I don't think there was much of a discussion. I think it was, I became an institution. Like that was my thing. Like that was what I did. I was the performer of the family and like whatever we needed to do to make strides. And especially when we got the opportunity to make the money, I think that was like, it made more sense. But I think it was like pathways were forged for so long, especially when we had left. You know, I had left when I was 8 and a half for about 14 months. And then I picked up on to another play for another, I don't know, 9 months, something like that. And then there was a little downtime, but then I did summer stock and I kept doing theater. So I was always busy working, always. And so obviously that meant that my mom was with me. So there was always this like new groove that we had. The dynamic of the family had shifted and they were only getting older. And then they ended up going to college, the two sisters, while I was in LA, they weren't even, you know, at home. So basically I had hit my stride with trying to be normal. I had gone and found some friends my freshman year in high school. And ironically, that year, which was the year before the pilot, I had booked a show called Parade. Parade was a really highly acclaimed, critically acclaimed play from Jason Robert Brown and Hal Prince. And it was at Lincoln Center and it didn't last. But the weird part was, is that the 1 year that I wanted to be normal and go to a school, a Catholic high school with uniforms in Connecticut, I ended up having to go back and forth after school. I'd go straight into the city and perform. So it wasn't like I could really do the whole party thing because I was doing 8 shows a week. So, but that daily school thing and that whole, you know, environment and trying to have friends, like that, at least I could have. Because then after that, I went back to a performing arts school the next year. And shortly thereafter, I took my severance pay because Parade had closed early and they gave us a check. And my mom and I went and we did pilot season, which was specifically at a certain time prior to streaming. And now pilot season is all year. But we went and I had like 10 auditions over the course of a month and booked the Spivey's kid brother. And I was 14 and a half at the time. And so, you know, I was coming off of a Broadway show and my first crush boyfriend thing that I was like really trying to like make a thing of it. And I was 16 when we got the call because they had deliberating to do, because, you know, Disney does that. And they deliberated for, I guess, almost like a year. Because AJ, you weren't in the pilot, were you?
No, I was not. Twitty came later.
Okay.
He was added.
They needed him for sure. Was Margo in the pilot though? Margo was in the pilot.
Margo was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, they deliberated for about a year. And so on my 16th birthday was when we started principal photography of our first episode of Even Stevens.
Oh, interesting.
And leading up to that, I had moved cross country with my mom and it was like a whole departing from my East Coast life to this free falling again on the West Coast. And I had no idea what I was. There was structure there, though. For, you know, 65 episodes, there was a structure and all that.
So you do the show, you do the pilot at 14 and a half. You go back to your life in Connecticut. Do you try to reassimilate again before you get the call that the show's getting picked up? Or are you just the whole time so anxious to get a yes or no?
It's funny. So I did the pilot at 14 and a half. I went back home and I was completely reassimilated. In fact, like I had early 16-year-old birthday party. I had a boyfriend of my dreams at the time. He was like the football player. And like, I was, I think I was going to school in New York. I'm not quite sure, but I had enough friends that I felt like I was starting to feel like a teenager. Like I had like memories that felt like, you know, something like Dawson's Creek. So I was like, oh my God, I'm not a freak anymore. And then I had this huge opportunity. So then things felt like, okay, this is positive, but I can't. I remember hating my life while driving cross country to start principal photography on Even Stevens to relocate. Hating my life, hating everything, being mad at my mom because, you know, that's what 16-year-olds do, but it wasn't her fault. We had like, I think we had two dogs and a minivan and we drove cross country and it was so, and I was crying the whole time and like probably using my flip phone to like text heart. Like three and
staring out the window, listening to Bare Naked Ladies and yeah, Third Eye Blind as you drive across the country.
I was cranberries.
The cranberries. Yeah.
Of course it was. Yeah.
That's that age. That's 15, 16. I mean, when I booked You Wish for Disney Channel, I had a girlfriend at the time and I was like, I almost said no because I didn't want to be away from her for 6 weeks.
Well, yeah, because that's an eternity.
That's insane.
Dude.
That's yeah. completely insane. But I actually had that thought, and my agent sat me down and was like, AJ, you can't turn down this movie for that reason. You can't do that.
That's what I mean. Is like, it seems like the crown jewel to fans and to young kid actors, you know, like everybody auditions for, you know, Disney shows and you want to be on a Disney show. And so you guys get the crown jewel. And what it looks like actually is you like, oh no, I'm fucking done. And that's such a wild thing to point out.
AJ can't talk about this because AJ was the chillest, coolest, like vibiest guy the entire time. And I don't know if you struggled. I'm sure like your dynamic with your mom and sort of just like having to deal with lots of different things. Probably. I don't know what you were struggling with. Just like, I didn't know what Shia was dealing with. Okay. Like I had no idea what was going on.
Everybody on that, every single person, young person on that show was going through stuff or was going to in some capacity. I mean, when we talked to Stephen Lawrence,
yeah,
you know, he was really open about his, you know, life outside of set and everything. And but sorry, AJ, you go ahead and answer because I don't know. I mean, did you have those pocket crystals and you just felt chill all the time? Or
my pocket crystal game was really strong at that period. I didn't really struggle much on Even Stevens. I felt great. It was so great. It was an amazing time. I tend to do really well when I'm achieving my goals and life is good. And like there was almost zero stress at that time on Even Stevens. It was great. But Christy, from my perspective, being friends with you during that time, one, you were a tiny bit older than me, maybe a couple of years, but at that age, it's like an eon beyond. You were prepping for college and getting ready and doing school with your mom. You didn't do school in the classroom with myself and Shia and Margot. You did school in your dressing room, if I remember right. With your mom, you seemed to be doing like some very serious classes and you seemed so put together all the time.
Wow.
What was actually going on when you would go in your dressing room to do school and stuff?
Well, okay. So do you want to know my actual interpretation of our friendship?
Yeah.
Okay. So I really wanted to be on really good terms with you, Margo, and Shia. And I felt like I couldn't connect with you guys. And I felt like there was this like, and now I'm realizing as an adult, that probably was all in my mind. And I was just very lonely. But like, I was trying to like, I felt that, you know, even from the audition, Shia and I were so vastly different. And granted, I was 14 and how old did we see? Like 10, 11, 12 years old. And so even from the beginning, our energies were so different that when, you know, Even Stevens, Spivey's kid brother, was reinterpreted to be a shared A and B format, there was an undercurrent for me of he's number one on the call sheet, I'm number two. And that I felt like sometimes he was obviously going through a lot of stressful things, but that I felt like there was a power struggle at times between me and him. And sometimes we would really butt heads. And so because AJ and Margo were kind of his best friends and the same age and confidants and best friends on the show, I didn't feel like we were a part of the same cast, kind of like that similar feeling of like my siblings and not feeling like I was in the same family. So I was jealous a lot of times of you guys hanging out and doing your things that were probably more age appropriate. And I felt kind of like I wanted to be closer to you. And so I was so tickled to be able to reconnect with you for CKT and like be able to like see how you've been growing and maturing. And you're just such a great guy. And you've always been a great guy. And I've always been a huge fan of yours.
I have one question. When you were talking about that, did you have to do school separately, or was that actually did you decide to do that because of that way you were feeling with the
three of them? I didn't think that the schooling was enough for me to get into an actual college, and I had been told by my family.
You're definitely right.
Oh yeah. I mean,
you're the only one probably who went to college.
We were doing nothing in that classroom but just arguing with the teacher about bullshit, and they were like, we were eating it. It was ridiculous.
But the only person that really didn't benefit from that system, or maybe he did, was Shia, because he was the one who was every day there and you guys would come in and out. I personally couldn't focus in that environment. So what I did was, as soon as I could, I was doing my studies after work. So I would rest. And then I had a different, especially in my junior and senior year, I had TAs from UCLA teaching me different. And this is all credit to my mom. Like, it was a different subject every day. And then on the weekends, I'd started to film Kim Possible. I would record it and we would request that we would do recording on the weekends. And so I would go in and do several hours of that, and then I would do SAT prep after that. So I was
doing Kim Possible on Even Stevens?
I was, yeah. That last season was the first season of KP, yeah.
So you didn't have any break unless you were sleeping. You were just like nonstop working. And
I think I had some time off, and I managed to try to get into a little trouble here and there.
This is why we weren't friends at that age, because this is how we saw you, as being super driven, super dedicated, super organized. And we were just fucking off the whole time, going surfing and just like hanging out and listening to music, starting bands and like screwing around.
I guess you're right. I guess you're right. I guess I was.
You had your shit together. We would have just distracted you. You didn't want.
But did I have my shit together, or was I just addicted to structure? You know, like I think like I'm still. Sure. I'm still dealing with that. And I think if you take anything away from this as me, as a sort of specimen in terms of this journey, I think my MO is, you know, structure is safety, you know, and maybe it's a balance of that, that I am still struggling with. And I ended up marrying a Marine, and, you know, he's also obsessed with structure. We make great producing partners together.
I have a lot of questions that come to mind. Like, I have a question for you guys in general, like on Even Stevens. I just feel like it's, and this is where it comes from. I came onto your guys' set, you know, for a hot second. And in that second, I felt like I had suddenly gotten involved with the dopest, like you guys were having so much fun. Like this was not, what I was groomed to be a little professional, you know, you shook everyone's hand, you were polite. It's like this. And I got there and I think like AJ was playing guitar in the lobby. Everybody was just hanging out. Everybody's really familial. It was a shock to my system. I was like, oh shit, this is what it's like behind the curtain. Like I've been auditioning for all these Disney shows. And I was like, oh, you guys are super chill. Why am I sitting going into these rooms like trying to be whatever, you know? And I show up, and then on top of that, it's like, you know, later on I dated Margot. That was my first girlfriend. I remember running back into Shia I was auditioning for where you guys filmed, but for something different. And Shia was there. And now I'd been hanging out with Shia, and he opened up his backpack. He was saying, I was like, what are you doing here? He goes, I'm showing the producer a short film I wrote. I was like, oh, dope. And he goes, yeah, you want to read it? It's like a page. I was like, okay. And he opens up his backpack, and his backpack reeked of weed, just like stuff. And I was like, yo, Shia, you're about to walk into a producer's room. And he was like, nah, man, it doesn't matter. I was like, no, dude, Shia, you can't. You're like 15 years old with a bag full of weed about to show. What are you? And that to me, like these impressions that I got of that set were ones that felt not at all like what I thought being on a Disney show was and the world of it. It felt very much like an actual dream come true. You're like, oh, nobody expects you to be. You can totally be a teenager. It doesn't matter. Everyone's here. Everyone here is friends. There's the difference between when you start rolling and when you're not rolling is barely there. You know, everybody's just snacking, rolling, got action and go, you know, and that's it. And I've always wondered then from like, it sounds like you guys had two different experiences, but overall, like that whole show, you know.
So I actually think, and in listening to you, I think that there is a vast difference between the way that a female coming of age experiences this set life, even albeit me being super type A and all that stuff happening. I think the set life itself, ours was unique, and we've done many reunions. AJ and I have facilitated them, and we've had a blast, and everyone, and even the Zoom reunion that we did, everyone is still very connected, and they all... we're all connected on Facebook, and they all know everything about us. And, you know, I'm sure if we ended up ever doing some sort of a reboot or some sort of something, like they would all like stop anything that they were doing and no matter the budget, like want to be a part of it. And, they even say like, this was magic for us. Like, and they work on so many different productions, but for whatever reason, there was magic being done on that set. And I mean, if you ask me, Lizzie McGuire wouldn't have come to be if our show hadn't shown potential and promise. I mean, we came before Lizzie McGuire. You know, our musical episode did so well that I think it started to tip, because we were really at the precipice of Disney Channel starting to do musical content and, you know, synergistic collaborations and different thinking outside the box in the comedic space with the single camera stuff, and doing like Fred Savage's first episode using like, you know, high-end directors. You know, it wasn't just weird, you know, kids content anymore. Like there's nothing even to compare it to. But they were trying so many different things. Our show was the quality content that they had hoped to be making, and they never could replicate it. They haven't replicated it, if you ask me. I'm not sure if they ever will. I mean, even if we were to do a reboot, I'm not even sure. Without Shia, how are we able to create that mania, that chaotic, comedic spirit? There has to be a new kid that has that in him that we would have to find to be able to put him into it.
Well, and Christy, you started to talk about the experience of being in a young woman coming of age,
yeah,
and what the set experience is, how the set experience is different for a person in that situation than maybe a young boy would be. Like, what was your experience where that's concerned?
Great idea. So like, for example, like I think for like the guys, it was probably like, I can get away with anything. I can like flirt with the older, you know, stand-ins and extras, and I can just like do whatever and it's chill, right? Like that's the mentality. But for me, I felt very much on display. I felt on display for the Disney executives. Like I would be told by Disney executives to be discreet and modest when I was out at certain events and stuff. And I was, because back then they actually cared. It was pre-scandal. So it was old school Disney of like, you have, well, didn't we have like a morality clause? Like we had morality clauses in our contract that
you actually read your contract? I didn't read my contract.
I had to, yeah. And there actually like, there was some sort of an incident at one point.
I'm not surprised. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Totally.
But you know, I was always on display. It was my career that was on the line. If I was around someone or doing something, it was always going to come back to me. So that was not just in my head. It was not just in my head, for sure. So I felt very much like the older sister. I felt very much like the matriarch. I feel like I was the youngest, though, of four. So
well, then how the fuck? Yeah, but if then how the fuck does like Shia bring a bag of weed into the producer's office? You know,
talking like, about, I'm trying to think. Like, is it? Yeah, because it was their producers that were smoking weed with him. Probably, like they all smoked weed.
Yeah, everybody smoked weed.
You know, and it's like weed. Yeah. You know, like to them, weed was not a big deal, and they probably thought to him, "Well, I guess he could be doing worse things." I don't exactly know. I didn't even know that was happening. I remember this one time, and you guys can cut this out. But Shia literally said to me, he goes. And it was right when we started like dating seriously, right? And it was like right.
Were you and Shia dated?
Oh, God, no. Oh, God, gross.
Okay.
Excuse me? God. No, it was right when he was dating or hooking up and like actually hooking up.
Oh, I see. When you just started dating.
This happened to me, you know, and like we actually had a connection and we talked about it. And I was like, my first time. And he was like, well, my first time. And it was like really, really random. And he was like, oh, yeah. Like, I dyed my pubes. I was like, what?
I remember that. He dyed them pink along with a whole bunch of our friends.
He said, oh yeah, green. Wait, are you saying that this is something he actually did and he wasn't fucking with me?
No, he did it. Oh yeah. Yeah, this is the thing that's going on. Like a whole bunch of us started dyeing our armpits and our pubic hair.
You are all crazy. Oh my God. So he told me that he did this. He's like, yeah, I dyed it green. And I was like, you did? He's like, yeah, it gives the ladies a little something to look at. I'm like, oh my God. And I just remember having this like such a great coming of age conversation with him when I was like, this breaks down. No Disney. Like, this is who.
Yeah, that's not. Yeah. Yeah, that's far from the contract morality clause.
Yeah, for sure. A fly on the wall. That would have been.
Yeah.
So yeah, there was good times. You know, there was so many good times and so much support, I will say. Even being a female, having a lot on display, feeling a lot of that pressure, and also being sort of like the female lead of the show, right? So like with that feeling that everyone around me, if I got sick, would not be employed that day or whatever, right? Like it's like a part of that in your mind, you know that you have that power. And then just, I mean, I also felt pressure once Lizzie McGuire came out. I remember them coming on to the set being like, well, their ratings are really good, you know, and she's really coming up, and this, you know, this Hillary girl. And I was like, so jealous. And I was like, and then even Shia, like we had this like beef with their show, and it was kind of like precipitated by the executives at the time that were talent liaisons. And it was like, isn't that funny? The kids are kind of, you know, kind of angsty towards each other or something. It's like, it's not funny. That's sick. That's sort of
yeah. That's really sick to start posting a bunch of kid actors against each other based on ratings.
I do recall that the bit of competition between us, and I asked our producers on our reunion, on our Zoom reunion this year, Christy, if they felt that too. And they were like, no, not at all. We didn't feel that. So maybe it was just us and it came from the Disney talent people as you were
just
explaining.
They were like,
but I definitely remember that.
Gossip. Yeah. And it was Shia always saying funny things, and he tried to prank like the cast and stuff like that. And I think it was.
He was also a really competitive kid, though.
He was. I mean,
that I felt a lot of pressure to sort of be a mainstay in our like dynamic there, because he was very competitive and he was competitive with me, and it was this unspoken thing of you do you, I'm going to do me, and don't get in my way. And so I felt that, and I never tried to get in his way, but I really did care for him a lot. And as the years have gone by, like I it was very hard for me to watch his movies. Like, I haven't watched most of his movies. There was one movie I watched where it just broke my heart, and it was the Saints one. Do you know the Saints one?
No.
A guide to recognizing.
Oh yeah, the Dito Montiel.
Yeah, and honestly, like I saw Shia for who Shia I felt like was when we were together, like this like just gritty, raw kid that just was struggling, and like it just broke my heart, and I wanted to love, and I couldn't really bring myself to watch any other movies of his for a long time. I still don't. I maybe have seen one Transformers. And it's just because watching him is hard for me. Because I connect with him in a way that I don't think maybe he doesn't connect with me because he's got a lot going on, but like he's still my little brother in some weird, weird way.
Hmm. Have you ever run, like, when was the last time you saw him or ran into him?
I mean, it's so funny because like, he'll see me, he'll be like, "Hey sis, how you doing?" And it's like, okay, like you probably don't really believe that. But I actually don't know his opinion about me. And it's been so long that like, I just feel like I have to give up on that relationship or even a hope for that. And it's fine. Like, that's totally probably for the best, you know, but people are always asking me like, is she going to be on your cooking show? Are you guys going to, you know, this or that? And it's like, you know, it's sad, but I think I care for him best if I just kind of try to let him be and just be who he's going to be and just kind of be positive or funny about it and cheeky about it. What would you do? I mean, AJ and him were like best friends forever. And so were you.
I mean, we were buddies until we got in a fist fight. Yeah. And then that was the last time I've ever had a one-on-one interaction with him. We ran into each other for a while. So we got, I mean, I don't even know if you know that whole story.
Oh, you do, yeah.
So I'm dating Margot, and he lived in an apartment complex next to hers. And he showed up really drunk to her apartment once. And I was there. And then, you know, we had been friends, but we hadn't really hung out in a year or so. And he like started a weird Shia fight. It's the best way to put it. It's like every time I've seen like, you know, someone's been like, Shia got in a fight with this actor. I'm like, yeah, Shia's been doing that since he was 12 years old.
Scrappy.
And exactly. And for no reason, that's what happened, is like, he just literally started a fist fight. And I'm proud to say I put him down and that was it. And then I have not seen him since, except with like events. And I remember going to this event, I don't know, some years later, and it was like an award show, and I was presenting something, and I think so was he, or taking an award. And he was like the president of the United States. There was like a security guard around him, and he was bulldozing through this big room of actors, and he looked like he was on fire, you know? And I was like, oh dude, and that's it. And that's all I've ever seen. And I've never run into him again. And I have no idea. And I've heard 1,000 weird stories ever since. And, you know, and everything everybody else knows. Yep. And I don't know, I don't have much sympathy for the, you know, but I never knew Shia like you guys did, you know, and I didn't know him, especially in that context where you guys have a seemingly really innocent, you know, relationship as coworkers on this big show that really was the, you know, the catalyst, obviously, for his career and for yours. And
yeah, I mean, you know, he won an Emmy, man. And like, I remember sitting there because I'd been invited to the award ceremony, and I was like in a dress, and like we were, I don't know, in New York or somewhere. And he was there, and he accepted his Emmy. And I was so pissed that he didn't thank me, because I was there sitting, and he thanked everyone else at the table, producers and everyone. And then he didn't thank me. And I was like, God, he's got to know that. He's got to hate me or something. He's got to hate me. So hopefully he doesn't hate me. Obviously, I love him. And that be that with that.
I got to imagine when you're young or you're however old, 15 or 16, and that happens, and then, you know, watching where Shia goes in his career, like,
I mean,
what is that? Because we've talked, I mean, AJ's talked a bit, and I won't speak for AJ, but, you know, AJ and I, when we did our first episode, I asked him, I said, you know, we got to talk about that time where you come off Even Stevens and Shia becomes like a major fucking movie star and you're grinding it out as an actor and how that goes, because it happened for me too. Like, I'm not a part of Even Stevens, but, you know, I started watching my peers, other actors, you know, start to become legit, have these huge, huge careers. And sometimes I felt so not, I didn't even think about it for a long time. And then other times it would plague my head. And I was like, fuck, man.
You know, because, why? You know, it plagues our head a lot more because we've been at it for so long. And that's like, you know, we've been at it since we were 6 and 8. And, you know, and the crystals and the thing. And it's not just, oh, well, your career's just not going the way you want it to, like, get in an acting class. Like, if someone comes for my brand, okay? If someone comes for me and tries to take away what my show's about in terms of my nostalgic cooking show that I have on YouTube, or even just the fact that I like to engage with my fans about the past and people, it's somewhat rare, but I mean, I think that some people are like, whoa, don't talk about it. It's like, look, this is my life. This is my brand. This is what's working for me. You know, my career is mine to do what I want with it. If I'm not going to be an A-list movie star, I've accepted it. But what am I going to be? Because this is me. This is what I've dedicated my whole life doing. And if an agent, you know, isn't going to take a 30-something-year-old Caucasian actress and try to put her at the forefront of every audition, then I've got to feed my family and I've got to do things that are going to work. So if I'm not going to take off my clothes, I'm going to do the nostalgic thing. And that's what brings us to today. You know, I went back to Columbia. It took me 12 years to finish my degree. Ended up picking up my husband, right? Throughout that whole journey.
And it's like degree, whatever.
I know, right? I got my MRS, but, you know, I did end up finishing, and I was, the reason I finished was because I wanted to get my film degree from Columbia University, fucking useless. But I had a great time learning about cinema and that I wanted to be in charge, and that as much rejection and failure and insecurity that I had and opinions that I had about the industry, I could have more of a voice if I chose to. I could be a director. I could be a producer. And so I started to empower myself. And I ended up directing my first feature, which was produced or distributed by Lionsgate. And it was funny because it's actually like a Disney-esque kids movie. And it was cathartic to be able to take that kind of content and do it for myself. And I've seen other actresses do it, Marla Sokoloff and Melissa Joan Hart. And there's lots of other gals that are doing that stuff. Candace Cameron Bure. It's really cool to see a lot of us who've grown up in this industry start being on the other side of it. You know, when Fred Savage was our director, you know, was very inspired by that, but I didn't realize it till many years later.
I mean, AJ's producing now, and I watched AJ find that avenue in his life really intimately. We lived together, and him figuring out what he was going to do essentially if he wasn't going to completely throw all of his value and time and energy into just waiting on auditions and waiting for the results of auditions, what was he going to do?
Right.
And I think, I mean, you two in particular are people with really sophisticated minds, with smart minds, and you're quick. I know lifelong actors, and I know some actors that are lifelong that have been lucky enough to just continually catch breaks,
right,
and keep working and working despite years sometimes in between. And I know other ones that like haven't worked in a long time and are like Uber drivers, and they kind of fucking hate their lives, you know? And so I know all kinds of version of actors. And what I will say is there is a subtle small difference to, you know, it's of no surprise for me to hear you say, like, you know, I learned about cinema and I learned, oh, I could be in charge. I could guide a set. I could be a director, a producer, it, you know, and it's the same thing when AJ started really thinking about that and, you know, and finding this part of himself, this facet that I don't think you access as an actor at all. You don't need to, no one's asking you to, you know? And so you guys find a whole other part of you that is really empowering, and it's wonderful to see. And when you start to see a level of success like Shia's seen, or you start to see like yeah, where those paths diverge, you know, it is not easy on your self-worth, and it's not easy on your own ambitions and your own values. But I want to talk about the Teen Vogue thing, because I actually want to talk not just about the content of it, but about how you get there.
Yeah, I mean, I've been wanting to write the Teen Vogue article for a while. And at first, I think I was conceptualizing it because I felt like it was good for my like publicity. It was good for publicity. And a part of me felt like instinctively it was also good for me, but I didn't really start to feel that way until I was ready to write it. And then I think I pushed it off. A part of me wasn't mature enough to take on writing it. And then, you know, I had become a mother and sober, right? So alcohol was completely out of my life, which was what was really kind of messing up my 20s and just my choices in my 20s. So I just kind of started to really reflect over a couple years. And it wasn't like it was like I had to go to a 12-step program. I never did that. I was in Al-Anon way before I was in just in the personal choice to be sober. But once I got pregnant, I decided that that was a cause for a lot of issues and that I had to acknowledge it to myself to see some real change. And so I did. And I think at the point that I looked around and started to be very grateful for my platform growing and building, that I wanted to have a moment. I wanted to claim and reclaim my past and almost make amends. I think in that article, I make amends to people and I don't mention who they are. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like, and that's one of the steps in the 12-step program is like making amends. And I feel that that article allowed me to do that without having to contact people. And, you know, if they looked me up and that was what popped up, if that was like the last thing anyone read of me, then I would want them to read that. And now my life is living up to the expectation of that. You know what I mean? Of like living a good life, taking it one day at a time, growing with my husband as my partner in life. And then also we're having a lot of fun with being producing partners, trying to collaborate with friends and you know, just like with you guys, this has been a really, really personal conversation. And I wouldn't have been able to chat with anyone like this if it weren't you guys. So I'm glad that, you know, you all, you know, asked me to be on here. I was kind of hoping you would. So
I don't want to completely diverge from what you just said, because I think it's really beautiful and it's really wonderful. And I think it's really, you know, what struck me when I read that Teen Vogue article was not only had you come out on the other side of the of things, you know, but your clarity to it, your ability to communicate it. I really believe the what was really apparent there is like, you know, I think when you find a lot of success with kids' content as a kid actor, there is a certain amount of, I think, responsibility that I see a lot of former kid actors feel beholden to in terms of their in terms of their fan base, because it's youth. It's a lot of kids,
yeah,
you know, that watch you guys. And living with that as you become an adult and being able to find the room in your life to struggle with whatever it is you're going to struggle with in life, and doing that while measuring up with a certain idea that has been like instilled in you, I think is really fucking difficult. I really do. And I don't think everybody comes out of that unscathed or even gets through it. And so when I see it, I saw this, you know, you talk about making amends in that way. I also see that there's like, there's an acknowledgement there that you put forth. I think that's really brave, that I don't know if you realize not everybody's willing to do. Not everybody's willing to come out and say like, yo, the really easy road is to say like, I'm going to skip my talking about my 20s
yeah,
and I'm exactly who you think I am. And that's it, you know, and to reveal this sort of multifaceted human that you are, and not in a way that is like to, I don't know, to like shun that idea either. Like, it's not like you shat on it, you know? I mean, I loved right off the bat, you said, I'm not a victim. That isn't this, you know?
Yeah.
And I loved it. I was like, there's no, you didn't shirk responsibility, you know, for any part of your life. Because I think part of the stigma and why I'm going off so much here, you know, is like, you know, the stigma of the kid actor is very known. And the stigma, you know, is that you're like a train wreck waiting to happen. And my personal belief is that all the things I've struggled with as a person outside of acting, and, you know, which has been a lot of shit and a lot of family stuff and a lot of, you know, I'm sober. I've like blown money. I've done all kinds of regrettable things, or at least things that I really had struggled to work through. And all those things I believe would be there whether I was an actor or not. you know, but there was definitely an added layers because I was an actor onto those things. And
so many layers.
Yeah, so many extra layers that are thrown on.
You need clarity. And
you do.
Let's say that I had the moment of clarity and the calling to write that. And I sat down and I engaged with Teen Vogue and asked them for the shot at it. They did edit it a little bit, but for the most part, those are my words. And I'm really proud of it. I appreciate you guys taking the time to read it. Thank you.
It was very well written. That's those college years. Because in the article, you touch on the fact that you really wanted that experience and it was something you always looked forward to and that you were somewhat disappointed that it didn't live up to your expectations necessarily, and that people in the industry told you, well, look, you're making a sacrifice. You go to school, you're like, forget your career. When you come back, it's basically hitting the reset button. Do you have any regrets around that decision? Like, how do you look at that now? Does that seem like the right thing to do, to go to school? Or do you wish that you didn't and just stayed and built off of that momentum from Disney Channel? And
I have very few regrets, which might be an issue and something I need to work on for myself, because I've blocked out a lot of what I felt growing up in the industry. Even as a young kid, there's so much I don't remember. I don't know if Chris, you feel this way about some of your younger years, but like, I really just blacked out like a lot of it. I don't remember.
100%.
I don't regret doing that. I think there was value in that. I don't know what I don't know, right? Like you mentioned that before. I didn't know what I didn't know. Looking back, I can forgive myself for being the person that I was, because I understand more than anybody what I was going through. You know, certainly I don't want my daughters to be going through these things. And so it's now my social work at home to make sure that they're understanding the ways of the world. So I may have a little bit more to work on upon speaking with you guys. I think I hope that's what the day did. Thanks. You guys going to bill me later?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We'll start doing this once a week.
Great.
Christy, when your mom's staying with you right now, do you get the opportunity to ask her the question, like, what were you thinking? Why did you allow me to go through all of this stuff and move across the country and pursue all of these things? Do you guys ever talk about it from that perspective?
Not yet. I feel like it's an unspoken sort of understanding, because I think when we stopped working together when I was 21, mostly because of a toxic relationship that I chose over our working relationship, we stopped working together, and I do regret that. But, you know, at a certain point, she was going to have to step back. So it wasn't a easy transition of power in any way, shape, or form. And I didn't have a good manager or agent to really give a shit about my personal well-being, even though I was doing big things with like ICM and like coming off the Broadway show and all that stuff. So it was unfortunate that happened the way that it did. It's unfortunate that I don't have like as much of an investment portfolio that I could have had. You know, like I think of things more in that way. And I think she and I have talked about it and stuff. But again, you don't know what you don't know. And like we've said in the past, like the parents, they do their best and they're just figuring it out too. And they're all free falling. And I think what concerns me sometimes is some of the executives feel as though it's not their responsibility to raise the kids. They kind of say, you know what? It's not us. It's not us. It's the parents that, you know, they need to parent their kids, and we're just going to be making money.
We're only laughing. I'm so sorry, because this is me and AJ's argument where he goes, the executives being responsible. And I go, fuck that. It needs to be better parenting. And he goes, no, it's not. And it's really funny to hear you.
Hey, let's just unbias. Let Christy talk.
I know.
About-
I'm so sorry, but she's looking at us like, why are you guys smirking like children right now? Like,
no, what? No.
So I'm sorry. No. I want you
to let Christy continue. Yeah.
So there needs to be a social worker. Okay. I'm not saying that it needs to be the executives, because they've got enough on their plate, but the talent liaison, the people that were inciting competitive, toxic work relationships between us and other cast members, I feel as though, you know, and that person didn't end up working there much longer anyway. So that's not something that is persistent. I would like to point that out. Disney is not a problem. But I do think, and there was a social work initiative at SAG that was called the Looking Ahead Program. Fred Savage was the ambassador of it or whatever.
This is amazing. Yeah, this is for kid actors?
Yeah. So it was defunded, sadly. And it was operational for, I think, like maybe 5 years or something. And I was doing a documentary where I interviewed Stephen as one of my sort of case studies when I was at Columbia.
Stephen Anthony Lawrence.
Yeah. And I knew about...
Oh, okay.
It was there that I found out about his past and I had no idea. And he had told me, no, don't use any of this. So I sat on that and I couldn't do anything with it. But the documentary that I was trying to do was a short form for a senior project in at Columbia. But I wanted to do a documentary that HBO did some shit version of this. But what needs to be done is a documentary that exposes that, you know, child actors are child laborers. And that if there's not social workers representing them on a semi-consistent basis on site and also representing their interests on an executive level, then I do think that there's problems. And I think that's why we see this laughing, cheeky, oh, they're a train wreck. Let them fucking die. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not fucking funny. These are kids. And these, you know, what I appreciated about SAG's initiative, I came in, they let me use their space. I was like trying to volunteer for them. I had to do a lot of background, you know, they had to check my background and anything like that if I wanted to come in and even just like offer pizzas. But they would do for the parents, they had a social worker, they would talk to the parents and do like Coogan Law, like classes. And then they would have classes for the kids. And then they would break off and have basically play dates that were for certain age ranges. And there was three different age ranges. And it was so good. And it was so great. And it's just so disappointing that that doesn't exist network to network. Now, the thing that I've noticed that Disney's doing now is that they have some social media training that they're working on. They have a program where a lot of the new batch of talent comes in and they do like a prom and they like do a whole fun thing. And they try, I would imagine that it's probably pretty intimidating and scary for these new talented kids coming into this, feeling like there's this legacy and that there's all this social media pressure and there's just like this obligation for them to post on behalf of their contracts. And it must be so much more complex than what we had to deal with. And that's the truth.
Yeah, because a morality clause in a contract is far different from, hey, you need to post about your life in a certain way.
Exactly.
And to be
Before we get too far off of it, I just want to touch on one thing and just agree with you, Christy. It's so important. It would be so important to see somebody on set that could speak up for what's okay and what's not okay for the kids and for the kids' parents, because kids aren't capable of doing it for themselves. Parents a lot of times feel intimidated or they don't know either.
Or they're ignorant, right? So they don't know the system. It would need to be somebody that is working with – and really this is the thing I think we're seeing with the COVID precautions is that can you buy off – a COVID person to come to set and be like, oh yeah, everything's all good. Like I just recently knew somebody who was working on a set and they were like, oh yeah, we've got a good in with that COVID SAG person local here. And it's like, okay, well, you don't exactly want to tip the scales for stuff.
You don't want the COVID person to cheat on your behalf and everybody gets sick.
But it should be as serious when you think about it now as a parent, Chris, like it should be as serious to not cheat on whether a child has a 12-hour turnaround time or whether they're, you know, feeling unsafe because of even just moving to a new state away from their family and that they don't have any mental health support and maybe they should see a therapist. And like there needs to be more structure, I guess, is what I'm saying. And maybe that's not such a bad thing in this case. But
Christy, I totally agree with you, Chris. In your face.
this is
Chris, in your face.
The parents just
heard. Yeah, well, had you spoke as eloquently as Christy just did, I'd be on your side a little bit more.
No, you just like to agree with me.
Our email.
But I don't judge. I honestly don't judge. I think we have to fail upwards when it comes to this, because saying that these kids are statistics is just, it's inhumane.
We know too much now. It's ridiculous. We've been doing it too long. We know the pitfalls. We know where the problems are. Everyone's aware. We can pretend like they don't exist, but they do. And we can put systems in place to prevent those things from happening.
But here's what I will say.
Make it better.
And this is only devil's advocate at this point, because I actually love what you just said. And I think it's wonderful. And I will say this in relation to that, which is like, you know, your mom is incredibly bright, it sounds, in terms of the way that she managed your school life and your work life.
Yes.
And so she always had that avenue open to you and stressed it and was important about it and made it important. And you did. You went back and finished it. And it was always a part of your life. And And it was inescapable for you. And so that to me, you know, it's like therein lies the real thing that actually I think changes kid actors' lives. And that's their parenting right there. Because I had lots of people on sets that became little mentors at times to say to my parents and to me, like, hey, your kid should do this, or he shouldn't do that, or should, and like some advice. And we took them to heart, but ultimately
too much up to chance. Too much is left up to chance in that scenario, Chris.
Look, no, I know, maybe you're totally right, but I just
think totally
stressed,
right,
hearing it, I'm like, you know what, that would absolutely be absolutely wonderful. And you guys experienced something I didn't necessarily, which was I never did a job as a kid where I had a morality clause or where there was an expectation of me to go speak in front of things outside of set. I never got asked to do that stuff. So I don't know what that does to where it starts to bleed in. I had my personal life and my work life never actually came near it, okay, you know? And so that's a little different. So that makes sense. But what my point is that even through all of that, even if those safeguards were in place, I still think it ultimately does rest on the shoulders
sure
of parents.
You're not saying that you don't think that the safeguards shouldn't exist. You're saying that you don't know how effective, you don't think they're 100% effective. And that's totally
fine. Exactly.
And I think that's why I'm here, is to have you guys mediate through me.
One more point. The school system exists to catch things that aren't also exist. If there's things going on at home that aren't okay, oftentimes the school system is the place that catches these types of things. If a kid's if a kid's malnourished, if a kid comes to school with a bruise on their back or on their face, or like social services can step in. This is one of our great public institutions that exists as a filter to mitigate problems at home, because kids don't really have a voice. Mm-hmm. And so again, you put kids on set, you've removed them from the traditional school system, and you've taken out any type of systematized support for them if there are problems going on at home or something like that. So it can be exacerbated in set life. And these are just adding additional tools so that we can provide support when we remove the normal safety net that is the public school system or the school system in general from young people's lives, if they're going to go be professionals, that we replace it with something else that can help offer some of those similar services.
Exactly.
You guys need to start it.
We need to,
and I believe in you guys.
I think we need to lobby for this or something. I think like AJ and I should.
I think you guys should. But when you thought about this talk today, when you thought of us here, was there anything we didn't touch on that you thought we might or that you would want to?
Well, I mean, there is Christie's upcoming podcast that's going to
we need to touch on. Yeah, we want to talk.
I mean, everybody knows what you're doing with Christie's Kitchen Throwback and all the other great stuff that you and your husband are doing together. But this is a new foray. This is the next thing that's coming down the pipeline for you guys.
Correct. We're pitching it out right now. And so we're trying to find interest. Jaleel White has something too out there. I'm sure you guys know of it. What Burn the Curtain is placing itself into, understanding that there are lots of, and your podcast is amazing with your guys's dynamic. So like ours is my husband and me, and Brennan went to Iraq. He was deployed. He was a Marine. He's got a punk rocker and just a really hard childhood. Mom had him at 17. Ended up after the Marines, like going on the GI Bill to Columbia University. You know, he's awesome. He's my husband, right? I love him. But he's also got his cool story and this cool point of view where when I would tell him like, oh, I live in this narcissistic purgatory and, you know, I'm just going to keep drinking to like fix, you know, like be this tragically beautiful girl. He'd be like, put the drink down. You're going to lose me. I'm the best thing that's ever happened to you. And I went to war. So shut the fuck up. Yeah. You never ever have seen the hard truth of life like I've seen it.
Child actor problems are nothing in comparison for real, to the like, evils of war.
He came in and he stepped in and our struggles though, you know, I think I taught him a little bit more about how to be less reactive and to be sort of, so we've come together and through our dynamic, we're trying to get people's journeys that are outside of the industry. And I think that's what's cool is that we're looking for like type A, you know, Olympians or like people that have done these like crazy things. And we're going to try to isolate their struggles and try to unpack them. And right now, I think podcasts like this are really great. And like yours as well. It's like people are struggling everywhere. And we want to, talking about struggling is good because then you don't feel so alone, especially on a podcast like this, where these are people that you look up to. And so you can hear them really talk about, you know, what they've
the real shit.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really excited for that, Christy. Yeah, you're a me great too. Person to Thanks. Be able to speak to that. You do it so eloquently, and your husband's awesome, and you guys work great together, and your chemistry is so lovely as well. Having the two of you on there is just
it
a
is
lot of
for
fun,
a Marine. But... I was like, he'd have made a pretty good kid actor.
I know.
And he would have killed it.
He would have loved that. I'm glad he wasn't.
So our first thing, Christy, and it's always interesting for people that have kids, is if your daughters come to you at 10, 11, 12 years old, while they're kids, and say that they want to be an actor, what would your and your husband's answer be, you think?
Asking me today, I say absolutely not. Ask me when they're 10 and 12, and then I may have a different opinion. The world is so different. The ability for them to brand themselves is so different. They could technically just have their own YouTube channel that we produce for them, and then they're not on set and they're making millions of dollars based on the fact that they are consenting to it. And we're the ones that are putting away for them properly. Like, who better? There is the mentality of who better to do it than us. Right. But knowing what I know, I think I have some years of therapy before I push my kids into this industry. I think it lays on me right now. And if in time they're going to say, Mom, why didn't you put me in earlier? I'm going to say, look, because this is what you've been born into. And I wanted to make sure that we didn't rush into it. So I'm not rushing into it right now.
Good That's answer. A great answer. Yeah. It's always different. Most people, I would say 95% of people say no, they wouldn't do it, but it's always for different reasons. It's always nuanced. Yeah. Chris and I don't know our own personal answers. And so we're always that's why we ask everybody.
Interesting.
Yeah. We're taking a long consensus. We'll see how it goes. So then this leads us to our final question, which is, when you turned 18, Christy, what'd you do with your Coogan account money? I'm so excited for whatever this answer is.
I did two things. Okay. I think I did two things. I did three things. I did something fast. I did something slow. And I did something eternal.
Okay. There we go. Can we know what those things were?
Whoa.
I got breast implants.
You
Whoa.
Did?
I don't know if you noticed that before the Even Stevens.
I wasn't going to say anything at that age. You blew my mind at 16. I was like, oh my God. Holy.
AJ, you're so polite. He's going to be totally mum. That's so funny.
Kathy, I'm sorry, but it's.
I've been mum for 17 years.
I got breast implants.
But you blew my 16-year-old brain, Christy.
That's so funny.
I watched Cadet Kelly when I was like 16 and 17 when it came out. And my mom was, and I saw like in the uniform they put me in and everything. I was like, oh no. And my mom's like, you should get some boobs. I'm like, maybe I should. So 18, I got them. And so that was the something
you got
fast.
Those boobies. No way, really.
Something slow was I paid for college, at least for the year and a half that I went. And then something eternal, or it felt like an eternity, was that after I didn't go back to school, and I stopped making money in my 20s, the rest of my Coogan account I lived off of for like 5 years or something like that. So I lived off of that money, and it was my safety net till I was in my mid-20s. Yeah. I wish I would have got a house. I wish I would have invested it differently. But you know what? Like, is what it is.
You know, thank you. Thank you, Jackie Coogan. You had a tough childhood and your parents spent all your money, but now we got the Coogan account and the great things can come from it.
You know, I know his brother, right? Or is his great grandson.
We like to just sort of wax. Now, we gave you some nice compliments, but and I'm trying to see if I can add to it, because I feel like I let the cat out of the bag with how wonderful I think your brain is and how many wonderful choices you have seemed to have made in your life, and you probably have no idea that it's a rarity. And you've contended with, I know you didn't contend with war like your husband. I get it. It pales in comparison, but I really understand the internal narrative and how you contend with that and how difficult that can be. And so it's really, from the outside, it's really, I think, really beautiful to see you take the shape of your life and make it something that you believe in and that you're happy and content with and that you have like really flourished in. It's really nice. Like not only have you like quietly done this inside, you've taken it and you've been really creative with it and put it into all these creative avenues. And that's so dope. I just think it's so dope. And me and AJ are so excited to like watch it grow and continue to grow and have been a part of, you know, reconnecting with you and that endeavor.
One of the highlights of my year, Christy, was coming on and doing your show.
Oh my God. Thank you.
Show.
Yeah. It was a great episode. It was really fun.
It's been wonderful knowing you all of these years. It's so great to see what you've grown into and this life that you've made for yourself with your family and your husband and all of this, taking your career into your own hands and making it something really great. And I'm so excited for the next things that are to come and your directing and all of this other really cool stuff that you're doing. So yeah, thanks for coming on. And
I'm just going to float it out there. If in a couple of years you're producing something and she's directing, I think that's going to be super.
That would be so tight.
Yeah, but we're going to need Chris to be the social worker on set. So
I'm going to be the social worker. Yep. And I'll make sure all the kids are safe. Save the children. Thanks so much, Christy, for saving all the kids with us. We appreciate you guys. You so much. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you guys for listening. You know, this episode is a long time coming for both of us, but for me in particular, Christy is a part of my Even Stevens family, even though we haven't spoken to each other in, you know, a long time. It's like coming together with a long lost sibling or a cousin or somebody. There's that instant kindred spirit. It was just great to sit down with her and be able to go over all of this stuff and to know that she's in such an awesome place with her family and her husband and everything that she's working on in her career right now. So really enjoyed this conversation. We hope that you guys did too. If you did, please rate us, review us. It helps a ton. And maybe share it with a friend. That would be excellent. And until next week, thank you guys very much. And we'll talk to you again.
See ya.
The ending was a little weird there, wasn't it, everybody?
It's a little weird, guys.
What you're going to get from me.
You can't hold it together for more than a minute, can you?
I'm like, I'm getting so close to the end.
Guys, I got to swoop in and save AJ at the end. Goodbye, guys. Thanks so much for listening.